The greatest story ever told is a true story. It is a story of adventures, battles, kings and queens, heroes and villains, good and evil, history and prophecy. It is your story. Come join the adventure of the Bible story. Chapter 101. God magnifies David. David was troubled. Hadadezer, the king of Zobah, was feared for his massive fleet of battle chariots. Fast-moving and nimble, the chariots could swoop down on an army and fire long-range arrows and then withdraw before Israel's densely packed infantry could get close enough to attack them. And if Israel's soldiers got too spread out, the chariots, which had sharp blades on them, could charge in and cause panic among the soldiers. David knew that God would fight for Israel. But David also knew that he had to do his part and plan for as many contingencies as possible. As the two armies neared, reports from David's scouts began pouring in. "The Zobahites are amassing their chariots in the plain," said one scout. "They are far ahead of their foot soldiers," said another. Upon hearing the news, David jumped into action. The biblical account provides no details about the battle that ensued. Given that it occurred alongside the Euphrates River, it is possible David used the geography to his advantage against the Syrian chariots. We can imagine the details. "Order our army to form up on the far end of the plain, where there is the dry riverbed. Have the soldiers march up and down in front of the river to stir up the dust." To his generals, David said, "Now listen closely to my plan." When the Syrians saw the Israelite soldiers approaching through the clouds of dust, the chariots moved closer to scout the Israelite position. The Syrians couldn't believe their eyes. "Those foolish Israelites must think they are invincible," said the chariot commander. "I can't believe they are so unwise as to march out to attack us head on. And they are all spread out." Instead of waiting for infantry support, the chariot commander yelled,
"Charge! Charge!"
At the sight of the chariot charge, the formerly brave-looking Israelite soldiers began to flee. But because of all the dust they had stirred up, the chariot drivers couldn't see what was happening as the Israelites disappeared into the clouds. The wall of chariots charged into the dust and into a massive river ditch. Horses crashed to the ground. Wheels snapped. Drivers and soldiers were thrown into the dust. Then the Israelite soldiers were attacking immediately. The battle was short and bloody. Soon, the Zobah king's chariot army had been wiped out, and hardly an Israelite soldier had been hurt. But that still left the enemy foot soldiers to deal with. The battle wasn't over yet. When Hadadezer saw his chariots charge, he assumed that the Israelites must have done something foolish. He immediately ordered his troops to attack. Even though he could not see clearly what was happening because of the dust, and his army was not in proper formation yet. Instead of moving down the field as one large force, individual units began trickling forward and into the dust as each one became ready. It was a huge mistake. After some time, as the dust began to clear, Hadadezer could not believe his eyes. His chariots were gone. And there was a massive Israelite army already overrunning his first infantry units. Now the Syrian soldiers were beginning to realize their predicament. They were spread out and almost defenseless. The first few Syrian units tried to make a fight of it, to buy the rest of the army time to reposition, but it was no use. In desperation, Hadadezer sent his cavalry to aid his soldiers. But Ephraimite archers and Benjamite slingers mowed them down from behind a solid wall of shields. By this point, Hadadezer knew that the battle was lost. But instead of ordering a retreat to save the lives of his soldiers, he ordered them to fight to the last man. Meanwhile, he withdrew to a safe location. He was not giving up yet. The loss of his army only made him angrier, but his revenge would have to come another day. He sent messengers to his allies in the Syrian city of Damascus, asking for reinforcements. God had provided another victory for Israel and King David. 20,000 Zobahite soldiers and 700 mounted cavalry were captured or killed. The Israelites also captured 1,000 chariots. Many people would have been ecstatic with capturing so many horses and chariots. But King David knew that God had forbidden the Israelites from building huge armies and using horses for warfare. This was because God didn't want the Israelites to put their trust in their own armies, but rather to trust Him to fight their battles. David kept 100 chariots for his own use, but ordered the rest to be stripped of their valuable material and destroyed. David also ordered that all the captured chariot horses have their ankle tendons of their hind legs cut so that they couldn't be used for war again. It took a while for the adrenaline of the battle to wear off. That was a good thing for the many soldiers who wanted nothing more than to go to sleep, because David and his generals first made them prepare for the next battle, which David suspected could take place the following day. David knew that Hadadezer was still on the loose and that he would not give up so easily. Sure enough, the next day, David's scouts reported that another, even bigger force composed of Syrian infantry was approaching from Damascus. But by now, with his army fully entrenched on the high ground, David could afford to bide his time. That night, the Syrians tried a surprise attack. But the Israelites were waiting for just that thing. Thousands of trained Israelite soldiers leaped up and charged down the hill and into the shocked Syrian forces. 22,000 more Syrians were killed as the night hunters became the prey. With the Syrian armies destroyed, the cities of Zobah were now at the mercy of King David. Many gifts of penance began flowing into David from the subdued Syrians. King David showed great mercy to the people. He put garrisons of soldiers in Damascus to make sure they would stay friendly and to ensure they would continue to pay tribute for all the damage they had inflicted on Israel. From the cities of Betah and Berothai, David took great quantities of brass, a metal that was very valuable for military and domestic use. It wouldn't be long before God put it to an even more important use. Word of King David's astounding victory quickly spread. Toai, king of Hamath, a small Syrian kingdom at war with Hadadezer, sent a packed train filled with gold, silver, and brass for gifts to Israel's king. More importantly, Toai sent his son Joram to congratulate David and establish diplomatic relations. God was exalting David and the nation of Israel.
not since the time of Joshua had Israel experienced such success. David's fame spread with his victories. Great wealth began to accumulate in Israel as subdued nations sent gifts and tribute. But this is where David differed from the kings of surrounding nations. Instead of building a fancier palace or hiring mercenary soldiers to fight for him, David set aside all the silver and gold and precious metals toward a building fund for a future house for God. David was intent on doing all he could to help build God's house, even if he wasn't physically allowed to do it himself. Because David's heart was right, God blessed him and the whole nation. Following David's military victories, a period of relative peace began in Israel, and David turned his attention to organizing the nation and establishing an efficient government. David did his best to execute judgment and justice throughout the land. Firmly in control of a united and increasingly prosperous nation, David put his most competent and trusted allies in the most important positions. One exception may have been Joab's reappointment as general over the army. Joab had angered David in the past and had shown himself to be not entirely trustworthy. But because David had promised the position to the person who captured the city of Jerusalem, David kept his word. Joab was a violent man who was very efficient at conducting warfare. He fulfilled this post well for many years, but had a habit of taking matters into his own hands, rather than following the king whom God had established on the throne of Israel. It is very important that people placed in positions of leadership and prominence have shown themselves loyal to God. This is a lesson that David would have to learn more deeply. Zadok, for example, would be a loyal high priest throughout his whole life, but David would live to see how much damage disloyal officials could cause. Reorganizing the government caused David to think back upon his experiences while serving in Saul's court. Even though Saul had become David's enemy, David always maintained respect for the office he held. He also fondly recalled his close relationship with Saul's son Jonathan and the promise the two of them had made to always show favor to each other's family. Does anyone know if any members of Saul's family are yet alive? David asked. Soon after, a servant reported back, "Sire, I have great news. We have found a man named Ziba who used to manage Saul's land." David requested to see the man. When the trembling steward was brought in, David looked him in the eye. "Are you Ziba?" he asked. "Yes, sire. Tell me what you wish and I will happily do it," he replied, as he looked up at his king. "Is there not anybody from Saul's family left alive that I might show kindness to him?" asked David. Yes, there is, stammered Ziba. "Jonathan had a son who is yet alive. His name is Mephibosheth." "What? Jonathan had a son?" cried David. "Why didn't I know about this?" Perhaps it was because Mephibosheth was only 5 when his father died, and that was before you were king, the servant answered. "Mephibosheth is crippled in both his feet. He can't compete in sports or join the army, so he doesn't go in public very often. And since Saul was your enemy, Mephibosheth, has been afraid of you and has tried to keep a low profile. He now lives in a town called Lodibar. Bring him to me at once, said David. A couple of days later, Mephibosheth arrived. After limping into the courtroom, he bowed himself to the ground. I am your servant, he said nervously. Whatever you wish from me, I will do. David was excited to see the son of Jonathan, who used to be his closest friend. David could hardly contain himself. Don't be afraid. Stand up and come here, said David to the young man. I am not angry at you. I want to honor you and make sure that you have what is rightfully yours. But why would you do such a thing? Mephibosheth stammered as he bowed to the ground again. You fought my grandfather. Surely, I am nothing more than a dead dog to you. Nothing could be further from the truth, David said. Didn't anyone ever tell you? Your father Jonathan was like a brother to me. From now on, you will sit at my table and eat my food and be like a son to me. Mephibosheth didn't know what to say. Then David called Ziba and said, All the land that you take care of for your master Saul, I am giving to Mephibosheth. I expect you, your sons, and your servants to take care of the land and to produce food for your new master's household. You will report to Mephibosheth, but he will live here in Jerusalem and eat at my table. Since Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants, he was very happy at this prospect. It would be more work for him, but also a way for him to earn more income to support his family. He immediately assented. For the rest of his life, Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem and was treated as one of David's own sons. David truly cared for Mephibosheth. But he was also showing due respect to the office of God's anointed and wanted to make sure Saul's family had an inheritance and was still treated as royalty. Eventually, God blessed Mephibosheth with a son of his own, whom he named Micha. Soon, sad news reached David. Nahash, the king of Ammon, had died. Nahash had shown kindness to David at some point, probably during the time David was on the run from Saul. Maybe he had offered food and shelter to David and his men. The Ammonites and the Israelites were often at war during Saul's reign, but since David became king, civil relations had existed between the two nations. Regardless of the specific reason, David wanted to do something nice for Nahash's son, Hanun, who was the new king. David dispatched emissaries with gifts to Hanun to offer his sympathy and encouragement. Once the emissaries crossed the River Jordan, at a point just north of the Dead Sea, they headed east through the territory of Gad until they reached the Ammonite city of Rabbah. The reception they received was totally unexpected. At first, the ambassadors were welcomed and shown into the king's court. But from there, events quickly deteriorated. Hanun's closest advisors, the princes of the land, began questioning David's intentions. Do you think that David is really that concerned about you? Don't be fooled by his supposed gifts, they said. These comforters he has sent are really just an excuse so he can spy out the land. David had conquered the Philistines on his west coast, and he defeated Hadadezer in the north. Another warned, don't think that just because your father helped him a long time ago that he won't attack here next. We need to send him a message that we won't be trifled with. The foolish Ammonite king believed their mistaken reasoning. He seized David's messengers, had their beards shaved half off, and their long garments cut in half almost up to the waist. The Israelites were then roughly escorted to the border and told to go back to wherever they came from. In those days, it was a grave insult to shave a person's beard and cut his robes. It was so humiliating that the men were ashamed to even appear in public. Once David heard what happened, he advised the men to reside in seclusion near the city of Jericho until their beards grew back before returning to Jerusalem. Meanwhile, Hanun was becoming worried that he may have stirred up a hornet's nest for no reason. To be continued in our next episode, and continue the adventure by reading the Bible story. Find it under the Resources tab at pcg.church.